Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Amos chapter 9, which I will entitle The Destruction and Restoration of Israel. We'll go through this last chapter of Amos. Amos was prophesying between 782 and 740 BC, right before the destruction of Israel by Assyria in 722 BC. We begin now with Amos chapter 9, verses 1 through 4. I saw the Lord standing beside the altar, and he said, "Strike the capitals of the pillars so that the thresholds shake. Knock them down on the heads of all the people. Then I will kill the rest of them with the sword. None of those who flee will get away. None of the fugitives will escape. If they dig down to Sheol, from there my hand will take them. If they climb up to heaven, from there I will bring them down. If they hide themselves on the top of Carmel, from there I will track them down and seize them. If they conceal themselves from my sight on the seafloor, from there I will command the sea serpent to bite them. And if they are driven by their enemies into captivity, from there I will command the sword to kill them. I will fix my eyes on them for harm and not for good." Now in verse 1, Amos sees the Lord standing beside the altar. Now where is this? Is this the altar in the temple at Jerusalem? Or is it beside the altar in the temple at Bethel, the golden calf altar? There's a split of opinion on that. Let me start with the pulpit commentary's view that this is the altar in Jerusalem. That commentary says this: "It is natural at first sight to suppose that the sanctuary of the northern kingdom is the scene of this vision." And of course, that would be Bethel. Dan and Bethel is where the two golden calf temples were. So let me repeat here from the pulpit commentary. "It is natural at first sight to suppose that the sanctuary of the northern kingdom is the scene of this vision, as the destruction of idolatry is here emblemized. But more probably Bethel is not meant, for there were more altars than one there. And one cannot imagine the Lord standing by the symbol of the calf worship." Well, the public commentator says that Amos in chapter 3 says there were altars of Bethel, and here the Lord is standing beside the altar. I think that's weak. Just because there are three altars, that doesn't mean the Lord can't stand beside one altar. And the other argument the pulpit commentator makes: "One cannot imagine the Lord standing by the symbol of the calf worship." I can imagine it. He could be getting ready to whack it in the vision. So I don't think that this is a good argument, really, from the pulpit commentator. So let's look at the other option, that it's the altar at Bethel, the golden calf altar, that is being referred to here. And the reason for that is because the prophecy is concerned with the northern tribes, as most of Amos is concerned with the northern tribes, not always, but mostly. And since it's concerned with the northern tribes, it would make sense that God is standing beside an altar in the temple of the northern tribes. This is what Barnes says: "Since Amos had just been speaking of the idolatry of Samaria as the ground of its utter destruction, doubtless this vision of such utter destruction of the place of worship, with and upon the worshippers, relates to those same idolaters and idolatries. True, the condemnation of Israel would become the condemnation of Judah when Judah's sins, like Israel's, should become complete, but directly it can hardly relate to any other than those spoken of before and after Israel." In other words, the context is Israel. And the reason the Lord is standing beside the altar is he's about to destroy it. He says, "I'll kill the rest of the people with the sword after I knock the pillars of the temple down so that the thresholds shake, and I'll knock the pillars down on the heads of all the people." That's why he's standing by the altar. So I think Barnes has the better of that argument. So we will assume that Amos sees God standing beside the altar at Bethel. After God kills the people in judgment inside the temple there, then the rest of the people who aren't in the temple, he'll kill with a sword. In other words, when the Assyrians come. "None of those who flee will get away. None of the fugitives will escape." Now, in verse 2, here's how they might escape. They might try to dig down to Sheol, the place of the dead, the underground, the underworld. Can't get any lower than that in Hebrew thought. And so this is an example of Hebrew poetry extremes being issued. "If they dig down to Sheol, from there my hand will take them. If they climb up to heaven, that's as high as you can go. From there I will bring them down. If they hide themselves on the top of Carmel," that's Mount Carmel, in the northwestern portion of Israel, right there on the coast. I've been on Mount Carmel. It's pretty high. You look way up. You look from way up top, and you look down on the Mediterranean Sea. "From there, Yahweh says, I will track them down and seize them if they conceal themselves from my sight on the seafloor." Again, going from high to low. "And if they're on the seafloor, God will command the sea serpent to bite them." Now that sea serpent, as John Gill says, is either a leviathan, a whale, or a dragon. Nobody can translate those Hebrew words. It's a monster of some sort. And if they are driven by their enemies into captivity, which of course they were in 722, from there I will command the sword to kill them. I will fix my eyes on them for harm and not for good. So here's a lot of doom and gloom in the first four verses of Amos 9, a lot of judgment. We go now to Amos 9, verses 5 through 7. And the Lord God of hosts, the one who touches the land so that it melts, and all those who dwell in it mourn, and all of it rises up like the Nile and subsides like the Nile of Egypt. The one who builds his upper chambers in the heavens and has founded his vaulted dome over the earth. He who calls for the waters of the sea and pours them out on the face of the earth. The Lord is his name. Are you not as the sons of Ethiopia to me, O sons of Israel, declares the Lord? Have I not brought up Israel from the land of Egypt and the Philistines from Kaphtor and the Arameans from Kir? Now, that last verse 7 is problematic, difficult to understand at first blush. But let's go back to verse 5. God is said to touch the land so that it melts. Again, this is poetic language. Land doesn't melt. But if you think about it, if it is melting, that means it's being destroyed. And if it's being destroyed by being melted, all those who dwell in it will mourn. And then the land will rise up like the Nile and subside like the Nile. That's what the Nile River did, of course. On a regular basis, every year it would overflow its banks, run up into the fields on the side of the river, and then come back. And that's how they watered and fertilized their land, and that's how they lived in Egypt, so it's very famous. Well, if you take the land of Israel doing that, going up and going down, that's because it's melted. It's going up and down like water. In other words, things are not good in Israel when the Assyrians come. Verse 6, the one who builds his upper chambers in the heavens. Now, here's what a gentleman named Hubbard says about upper chambers. It is hard to catch the exact picture of what Yahweh is building in verse 6. The heavenly construction may be a staircase or a roof chamber. Well, I kind of think of it like a roof chamber, the sky being the roof. Put the roof chamber up on top of the sky, and the roof chamber will be in the upper heavens, and then the lower heavens, the atmosphere, will be below the roof chamber. Adam Clark says it's a room on the roof where people took the air. Guzik says the Hebrew is very difficult to translate, so we're not going to worry too much about exactly what it means, but the point is God's up there in heaven. Who else is in heaven besides God? Nobody. That's the real point, to show the majesty of God. And in verse 6, God has founded his vaulted dome over the earth. The vaulted dome, of course, is the sky. If you look at the sky, it does look like a dome because it's semicircular. Now, I don't know why it would be vaulted, except maybe earthly domes are vaulted. And maybe that's where the adjective came from. Here's what Barnes says about this dome. His visible heaven, which seems like an arch to span the earth. The whole then describes all things visible and invisible, the whole being the upper chambers in the dome, things visible and invisible. The upper chambers are invisible because they're in heaven. The dome is visible because we can see it down here. Barnes continues, all of this, our solar system and all beyond it, the many gradations to the throne of God. The purpose of this, of course, is to show God's majesty. And then at the end of verse 6, God is said to be one who calls for the waters of the sea and pours them out on the face of the earth. Now, there's a couple of options as to what that pouring out of water might mean, might refer to. Option number one, it refers to Noah's flood. This is Barnes's idea and the pulpit commentary's idea. God pours out the flood on the face of the earth. Well, that's pretty awesome. Some scholars say it's rain, just rain simply. As the Cambridge commentary says, the violent and long-continued rains occurring in eastern climates or another proof of Jehovah's power over nature, Yahweh's power over nature. In verse 7, we read this, are you not as the sons of Ethiopia to me, O sons of Israel? That's what Yahweh says to Israel. Why would Yahweh start looking at Israel as the sons of Ethiopia? Well, here are some options. Option number one, Israel thought that the Ethiopians were a remote and distant people. This is Guzik's idea. And so God says, you are far away from me, O sons of Israel. I don't really have anything to do with you anymore. That's reasonable. Option number two as to how the sons of Israel are like the Ethiopians to God. The Ethiopians were universally despised, as Adam Clark says. And so God is saying, just as everybody despises Ethiopians, I despise you, Israelites. The Ethiopians were the Cushites, and Cush was a son of Ham. And Ham's youngest son, Canaan, received that famous curse, which is sometimes erroneously called the curse of Ham. It was actually the curse of Canaan. And I suppose by association, the Cushites, the Ethiopians, were looked down upon because Ham was the father of a man who had gotten cursed, and Ham's other son was Cush, and the Cushites were the Ethiopians, and so the Ethiopians were looked down on. Now, Benson says they were a barbarous and cruel race of people. Poole says they were a wild, thievish, and servile nation, such as now inhabit those parts. Base, bloody, and thievish Arabs, hated and despised of all their neighbors, and so by the Israelites their neighbors accounted at that day. In other words, God is saying, you hate the Ethiopians, well, guess what, Israel? I hate you because of what you're doing. Here's option number three. The Ethiopians were out of the covenants of God, the covenant of Abraham, the covenant of Moses, but Israel was within those covenants. And so now Israel is behaving as someone that's not a covenant member. The Ethiopians are not covenant members. And so God says, are you not as the sons of Ethiopia outside of the covenant? Because that's the way you're acting. You've broken the covenant. And of course, Yahweh could have meant all three of those things. You're remote, you're distant, you're despised by me, and you have broken the covenant. In verse 7, Yahweh continues, have I not brought up Israel from the land of Egypt? That's referring to the Exodus, the famous Exodus. And have I not brought up the Philistines from Kaphtor? Kaphtor is Crete, most probably. The story of that is the Philistines came from Crete and settled along the southwestern coast of Israel. And then God also brought the Arameans, that's the Syrians, from Kir. Now, Kir, nobody knows exactly where that is. Adam Clark speculates it's somewhere in Media, but it's the origin of the Arameans mentioned early in Amos. But now the question is why does God say that? I brought you Israel up out of Egypt, and I brought the Philistines from Kaphtor, and I brought the Arameans from Kir. So what's the point of that? Here's a couple of options. Option number one, this is from Albert Barnes. The Exodus had become meaningless to the Israelites. It had become just like any other act of God's providence. In other words, God is saying, hey, yeah, I brought you out of Egypt, man. So what? I brought the Philistines from Kaphtor to the promised land. And I brought the Arameans from Kir all the way from Media, if that's where Kir is, all the way to the northeast of Israel. So I can do that sort of thing, but I didn't do anything special for you, because I've done it for other pagan nations, and those nations are going to be judged. I'm going to judge them. Of course, he did that when the Assyrians came in and wiped everybody out at that time period, right after Amos died. And so that's option number one. That's what Yahweh is said to mean there. The Exodus had become meaningless because it was just like other movements of people that God did. The Exodus had become just like any other act of God's providence. And so you're no longer special, Israel. Here's option number two. God is telling the Israelites to not presume on God's miracles done on their behalf. He had done miracles for a lot of other nations too. For example, he did an exodus for the Philistines, brought them from Crete, Kaphtor, to Israel, and he brought the Syrians from Kir to Syria. So he's done exoduses for them, just like he's done an exodus for the Jews, yet he judged the Philistines and the Syrians, just like he's going to judge Israel. So I think that explains that somewhat opaque verse there, verse 7. We go now to Amos 9, verses 8 through 10. Behold, the eyes of the Lord God are on the sinful kingdom. That's, of course, the northern Israel. And I will destroy it from the face of the earth, which he did, 722 B.C. Nevertheless, I will not totally destroy the house of Jacob, declares the Lord. For behold, I am commanding, and I will shake the house of Israel among all nations as grain is shaken in a sieve, but not a kernel will fall to the ground. All the sinners of my people will die by the sword, those who say the calamity will not overtake or confront us. Now, at first glance, this seems contradictory. In verse 9, God says not a kernel will fall to the ground, but then in verse 10, he says all the sinners of my people will die. Well, that's because there's always a remnant. When God judges, he always preserves a remnant to keep his covenant promise going. He made that promise to Abraham. Your seed will be a blessing to everybody, a blessing to the nations. If he destroyed the seed of Abraham, totally destroyed the seed of Abraham, well, then that promise could not be fulfilled. And so this is very typical of the prophets to talk about some mercy mixed in with judgment. At the end of verse 8, God says, I will not totally destroy the house of Jacob. As Ellicott says, the kingdom of Israel will be destroyed in 722, but the race will survive. The kingdom will go, the political kingdom, the geopolitical nation of northern Israel will be destroyed. But the Jews themselves, as individual Jews, will not be destroyed. In other words, not a kernel will fall to the ground, which is just a way of saying, after Israel is shaken like wheat in a sieve, as grain in a sieve, you shake the sieve, all the chaff falls out. You get all shaken up there if you're a grain of wheat getting bounced around, but you don't fall through because God is going to protect the remnant of northern Israel. They will not be destroyed. Now, in verse 10, when God says, all the sinners of my people will die by the sword, that's talking about people that God is going to judge. It's all the sinners. It's not all the people. It's all the sinners of the people. So there are going to be some who will survive. And they're cocky, of course. This calamity will not overtake or confront us. Not going to happen here. This is what Cambridge says about this surviving remnant. The solid grains, though violently shaken about, are retained and preserved, while chaff and dust fall through the meshes to the ground. So just to repeat the idea, not a kernel will fall to the ground. That means that each individual soul will be looked after by God, even though the nation of northern Israel is destroyed. We turn now to Amos 9, verses 11 through 12. Yahweh continues, in that day I will restore the fallen booth of David. This is the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. King James has the fallen tabernacle of David. Very famous verse. In that day I will restore the fallen booth of David. I will repair its gaps, restore its ruins, and rebuild it as in the days of old, so that they may possess the remnant of Edom and all the nations that are called by my name. This is the Lord's declaration. He will do this. In that day I will restore the fallen booth of David. Well, first of all, we need to know how the fallen booth of David fell and when it fell. So how had David's kingdom, we'll assume the booth of David is the kingdom of David, and David ruled between 1010 and 970, how had it fallen? There are two options here. The first option is that the kingdom of David, David's kingdom, fell when the 10 tribes under Jeroboam split the kingdom and set up the golden calf worship in 931. Jeroboam the first did that. He ruled between 931 and 910. Now, one problem with that is that the kingdom of David might be said to fall in the times of Jeroboam, 931 or so, but at the time that Amos was prophesying, 787 to 740, Israel was mighty and strong. The kingdom of David was a powerful nation. We read in 2 Chronicles 26:15, second part of the verse, so his, this is referring to Uzziah, who was king, between 767 and 740, and it was during King Uzziah's reign in the south that Amos was prophesying. So Uzziah's fame spread even to distant places, 2 Chronicles 26 tells us, for he was marvelously helped until he became strong. But Barnes points out that the time of the fall of the house of David was not necessarily at the time of Amos, because it says, in that day I will restore the fallen booth of David. Well, when did the booth of David fall? The verse just does not say. So you could say, well, it fell in 931 or so when Jeroboam the first split the kingdom up. Well, that's option number one, is to when the kingdom of David fell at the time of the split into the northern and southern kingdoms. Option number two, the kingdom of David fell when Judah was destroyed in 586 by the Babylonians, and that's what I think it is. And Kyle and Delich agree with me. After all, Amos had prophesied against Judah. He mainly prophesies against northern Israel, but he prophesied against Judah too. In Amos 2 verse 5 we read, therefore I will send fire against Judah, and it will consume the citadels of Jerusalem. So I'm going to assume that this fallen booth of David refers to the destruction of Judah in 586. Now, before we look at the options as to when this booth is going to be restored, this fallen booth, let's look at some translations, because I don't like that translation booth, to be frank with you. The American Standard Version, Darby, the KJV, and the Young's Literal translates the verse as tabernacle, the fallen tabernacle of David will be restored. The Darby note says, or booth, the fallen booth will be restored. And the Darby note says, or hut, the fallen hut of David will be restored. Bible in Basic English and God's Word translation says tent. Well, a tabernacle is just an old-fashioned word for tent. The New American Bible says hut. The Holman Christian Study and the New American Standard Bible say booth. One of my commentators says that the phrase the house of David, which means his descendants, the house of David is used of David's affairs when David was prospering, but this tent or hut or booth, since it's more of a lowly term, it refers to the house of David when it wasn't prospering. We read in 2 Samuel 3:1, the war between the house of Saul and the house of David was long and drawn out, with David growing stronger and the house of Saul becoming weaker, so the house of David is a stronger use of the term. And according to this view, to translate it as tent or booth, that expresses the low condition to which David's kingdom and family had fallen in Amos's time. The problem with that is Uzziah was doing just fine in Amos's time, and Uzziah is of the house of David. Well, however it's translated, it means the kingdom of David, his kingdom, which includes the kingdom of David's descendants. And the kingdom of David was Judah, the southern two tribes. Now, let's go to the interesting question as to when will the kingdom of David, the fallen tabernacle of David, be restored? Option number one, the kingdom of David will be restored when the prosperous kingdom of Judah arose after 722, when the northern 10 tribes were wiped out by the Assyrians, and before 586, when the southern kingdom of Judah was wiped out by the Babylonians. So between 722 and 586, Judah prospered. Option number two is to when the fallen tabernacle of David was restored, was the rebuilding of Judah upon the return from the Babylonian captivity. This is Joseph Benson's view. Jameson Fawcett Brown does not agree with that. He says, oh, that can only be a partial temporary fulfillment because the restoration did not include northern Israel. It only included Judah and it northern Israel. And northern Israel is the main subject of Amos's prophecies. To which I reply, yes, but it was the fallen tabernacle of David, and David refers to the southern kingdom. Jameson Fawcett Brown says, well, no, you can't say that Babylon is a restoration of the fallen kingdom of David because Zerubbabel's kingdom, Zerubbabel was the governor of the restored nation of Judah when the Babylonians let the Jews back into Israel. Zerubbabel's kingdom was not independent. It was not settled. It was harassed on all sides by foreign enemies, and therefore the fallen tabernacle of David could not said to be restored. Jameson Fawcett Brown say that all their prophets in their prophecies with the Messiah, and he's got a point there, the Messiah whose advent is the cure of all previous disorders. Well, Joseph Benson says that in addition to the rebuilding of Judah after the return from the Babylonian captivity, the restoration of the fallen tabernacle refers to the victory of Israel under the Hasmoneans, which is 2nd century B.C., when the Maccabees kicked out the Seleucids. Well, here's option number four. The fallen tabernacle of David is restored by the reestablishment of Israel and the Church of Jesus. Now, at the Jerusalem Council, James, the brother of the Lord, is one of the leading lights there, and he says this in Acts 15, verses 16 and 17. He's quoting Amos 9:11 straight up. After these things, I will return and rebuild David's fallen tent. I will rebuild its ruins and set it up again, so that the rest of humanity may seek the Lord, even all the Gentiles who are called by my name, declares the Lord who does these things. Now, this is in direct response to Peter's announcement of the conversion of the Gentiles in Cornelius' house. And so James is trying to say that the church is not just for Jews, it's for the Gentiles too. And that, of course, is the church. That's not the old Israel, which only consisted of Jews. So this is referring to the church, which consists of both Jews and Gentiles. So that's option number four, the reestablishment of the Church of Jesus. That's how the fallen tabernacle of David is restored. But Benson gives option number five, which I think is the correct option, the physical reestablishment of Israel after the Babylonian exile, when they came back in circa 538. They reestablished the physical kingdom. This is a type of the reestablishment of the church. The return from Babylon is a type of Gentiles flowing into the church and Jews flowing into the church after Jesus came. Let me read you what Benson says. He says, the Edict of Cyrus, that's referring to the edict that Cyrus issued in 539 or so when he had conquered the Babylonians who had imprisoned the Jews. The Edict of Cyrus was general, giving liberty to all the posterity of Jacob, wheresoever dispersed, to return to Judea. And many of the 10 tribes certainly did return, though the main body of those who returned consisted of the two tribes of Judah and Benjamin. This prophecy, however, must also be extended to the days of the Messiah, and to the calling of the Gentiles to the knowledge of the true God. And so St. James expounds it, Acts 15:16, that's the verse I just read, at the Jerusalem Council. For this was, emphatically speaking, raising up the tabernacle of David, In other words, this raising up of the church. So I think Benson has it right. It's referring to the return of the Jews from Babylonia in the first instance, but that is a type of how it was ultimately fulfilled in the church. Now, in verse 12, Amos says this, so that they, that's referring to the people who were not totally destroyed in the house of Jacob, those colonels who didn't fall to the ground, those individual Jews who survived even though the northern kingdom was destroyed, so that they may possess the remnant of Edom. Now, what does that mean? Well, as I've mentioned in earlier podcast, Edom was the nation of God, was the nation par excellence who opposed the people of God. They didn't want the Israelites to go through the territory when they were blocked coming out from Egypt on the Exodus. And so the Jews had to go up through Moab in order to get to the Promised Land. And Edom also jumped up and down in rejoicing when the Babylonians came in 586. That's very well known. The Edomites hated Israelites, and God was very upset with Edom. And so here in verse 12, these surviving colonels, these Jews who are not wiped out, may possess the remnant of Edom. In other words, what's left of the northern kingdom of Israel is going to beat the enemies of Israel. And how is that going to happen? Well, it's going to happen when the church starts converting all the nations that are opposed to God. As far as I know, the nation of Israel never did conquer the nation of Edom again after they returned from Babylon in 538 or so. Now, that's what Amos says. The people of Israel will possess the remnant of Edom. But now, when James quotes Amos at the Jerusalem Council in Acts 15, verse 17, he says this. James says this, so the rest of humanity may seek the Lord. The rest of humanity may seek the Lord, whereas Amos says they may possess the remnant of Edom. It's not quite the same. And the reason is because the Septuagint translated Edom as Adam, which is kind of close. And Adam, of course, not only means Adam as in Adam and Eve, it also means mankind, mankind. Or humanity, as the Holman Christian Study Bible has it. And so if we substitute humanity for Edom, as James did when he was quoting Amos, we get, so that they may possess the remnant of humanity and all the nations that are called by my name. Well, that works out pretty good, because Edom stands for all the nations that opposed Israel, in other words, Gentile nations. And so James is trying to show that the Gentile nations will be possessed by the church. So it works out nicely, even though he didn't quote the Masoretic text exactly. And so this is a wonderful prophecy of the spread of the church. This is the Lord's declaration. He will do this. We go now to Amos 9, verses 13 through 15, and we will finish this chapter, and we will finish the book of Amos. Behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when the plowman will overtake the reaper, and the treader of grapes him who sows seed, when the mountains will drip sweet wine, and all the hills will be dissolved. Also, I will restore the captivity of my people Israel, and they will rebuild the ruined cities and live in them. They will also plant vineyards and drink their wine, and make gardens and eat their fruit. I will also plant them on their land, and they will not again be rooted out from their land which I have given them, says the Lord your God. Well, Amos started out the chapter with judgment. Now he's going to finish up with restoration blessing. He says, days are coming. This is the Christian church days. Declares the Lord, when the plowman will overtake the reaper. Now, what does that mean? Well, the reaper from the previous harvest is reaping and reaping and reaping, and he can't get the harvest in because it's so plenteous. It's so abundant, so he keeps on reaping, and it takes him so long that the plowman, getting ready for next year's crops, he starts to plow, and the reaper's in his way because he's still reaping the previous year's harvest. And the treader of grapes, him who sows seed. There would be so many grapes to press from the previous harvest that the grape treaders would still be working when the next sowing time arrived. That's great poetry there. That plowman who overtakes the reaper, another reason he'll overtake the reaper, he'll want to rush ahead with his plowing so he can participate in all that fertility that's going on. At the end of verse 13, the mountains will drip sweet wine. That means there's so many vineyards with grapes that poetically the wine is running down the mountain and the hills will be dissolved. Instead of water making the hills wash away, it'll be wine. John Gill says, It could be honey, either with wine or honey, or rather with milk even, because the hills would be covered with flocks and herds. Guzik translates the verse, "The hill shall flow with wine." We got the idea. Verse 14, "Also I will restore the captivity of my people Israel." Now, that's the NASB translation. It sounds like the people are captive, they get out, and God's going to put them back into captivity because he restores the captivity, which is exactly the opposite of what he's trying to say. So this is, my opinion, a lousy translation. The Holman Christian Study Bible translates it as, "I will restore the fortunes of my people Israel, and they will rebuild the ruined cities and live in them." Now, of course, if this was referring to the return of Judah now, not the northern tribes, but Judah to Jerusalem in 586, the northern Israelites would have to participate in that return as they came from their scattered places all over the empire. But the ultimate fulfillment of this is in the church. And the idea is that Israel will rebuild the ruined cities physically, and that is a type or a symbol of the restoration of the church. They will also plant vineyards and drink their wine and make gardens and eat their fruit. Again, all symbols of prosperity, and it's referring to the church. "I will also plant them on their land, and they will not again be rooted out from their land which I have given them." Now, I realize there are certain people that will take that so literally that this is talking about the return of the Jews to the land in 1948, and they will not be again be rooted out. I don't think so. John Gill says it can't be that because the Israelites were indeed rooted out by the Romans in AD 70. Well, I would respond to that and say, well, temporarily or for a season, they weren't rooted out. So you could take that not quite so tightly, "they will not again be rooted out," means for the time being. But ultimately, it's the church that's not going to be rooted out of anything. The land is a symbol for the church. Well, let's look at the options of what restoring the captivity of Israel might be. Option number one, restoration from the Babylonian captivity, as I've just mentioned. Although John Gill doesn't believe that because, as I said, the Israelites were rooted out after they were restored from the Babylonian captivity. Option number two is the Christian church, as I've just said. Or, of course, the dispensationalist's famous go-to fulfillment, the future Jewish millennium. The Jews are going to be planted into the millennium, and they won't be rooted out from the millennium. And option number four, which in my humble opinion is the correct option, the restoration from the Babylonian captivity, circa 538, that as a type of the church. In other words, let's do the physical and let's do the spiritual, the physical being a type of the spiritual. This is typically how I've tried to interpret all these Old Testament prophets. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have finished with the book of Amos. We're now prepared to go to the book of Obadiah, which, praise be to God, is only one chapter long. As we plow ahead trying to finish the Old Testament, a podcast for each chapter, I hope you stay tuned for our discussion of the book of Obadiah in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.